Here is one of a series of talks by spiritual leader Lola McDowell Lee, spanning two decades from the early 70s through the 90s. Lola was a Zen Roshi, whose Rinzai lineage included Dr. Henry Plutov and renowned Zen master Shigetsu Sasaki. Lola was a religious scholar as well as an ordained Christian minister. While the talks are focused mainly on Zen and Buddhism, Lola drew on many spiritual traditions, including those of Jesus, Plato, Lao Tzu, the Hindu Vedas, Meister Eckhart, and Gurdjieff.
And if you can't hear me above the air conditioning, make up your own. You do it anyway, so. I don't know, for some reason, that when we come to this summer session thing, we hone a little more into Buddhism, and I think it's because it's so associated with Zen. And after all, the Zen sitting is what you're doing with the Zazen all week, and with the sticks and the everything else. So, anyway, out of the disciplines of transcendence, which I thought you would be interested in, we have such things as the Buddha said, those who study the doctrine of the Buddhas will do well to observe all that is taught by them. It is like unto honey. It is sweet within, it is sweet without, it is sweet throughout. And so is the Buddha's teaching. O monks, you must not walk on the way as the ox who is attached to a wheel. His body moves, but his heart is not willing. But when your hearts are in accord with the way, there is no need of troubling yourselves about your outward demeanor. Those who practice the way might well follow the example of an ox that marches through the deep mire carrying a heavy load. He is tired, but his steady gaze looking forward will never relax until he comes out of the mire, and it is only then that he takes respite. O monks, remember that passions are more than mire, and that you can escape misery only by earnestly, steadfastly thinking of the way. Now this is I don't know if we have ever given any thought to, or if you have, maybe you have, that this whole time that we spend here in what is called existence, in this phenomenal world, is a learning experience. It is as if, one could say, we are writing a story. And the story is about ourselves and what we learn. And I think maybe if you viewed your life in this manner, you might do some things a little differently so that the story would come out better. I mean, if every night you had to write down all the experiences that you had during the day and what you learned out of them as to become a part of the story, so that at the end of your life, you should sit down and read all of this, you know? And, you know, then comes a time when you begin to think, well, I just can't have, today I goofed off, you know, it should be a little bit different, you know? The learning process that goes into this story that is my life. So, Anyway, this span of time that we have, that we call life, it should part of our time, you know, and a lot of our heart should be focused into this inner pilgrimage that is called the way or the path. And of course, it is a way that we go alone. Now, we meet as a group, and we sit as a group, and we work as a group. We maybe have become so enjoined in this that we can call ourselves a family. And yet, each one within the group is on his own, and in his own way, is seeking the way. In the nature of things, as we find them, this is the only possible way. I mean, we can't, there was like this preacher that got up, and he was lecturing his congregation about everybody going to heaven and nobody going to hell, and he was telling them what they had to do, and he was doing it with a great deal of vim and vigor, and so then finally he got to the place, and everybody's saying, amen, hallelujah, brother, and he got to the place where he says, everybody who wants to go to heaven, stand up. And the whole congregation stood up except our monk. And so the preacher said to him, you don't want to go to heaven? He says, oh yeah, but I ain't going on no excursion. That we do this thing alone, no matter how together we are, it still is an alone thing, because each of us is at a particular state, trying maybe to get to the next state, or at least hold our own where we are. So that we find that truth is something that is inside. It's not something that is out there. So, therefore, it is an alone thing. If we're out there, and you could go take it up in the garden, we could go in a company. We could go all out at night and take shovels and find it, huh? You can't do that. It's inside of each of us, and therefore it is an alone journey. So it is something that is very subjective. It's way at the inner core of yourself. And at the inner core of yourself, only you can penetrate. And it is a way, this inner core, to get to this inner core. It has no signposts. It is not guided. There are no maps. The whole territory is yours to explore. So that's, this territory you're exploring, that's why it's a story in a way. Huh? Our lives are a story. And the whole thing really is very exciting. To find out about oneself, to learn about oneself, is tremendously exciting. However, as on any journey that we take, we must make some provisions. We need provisions on this way. Now, the Buddha called these provisions paramitas. Which can lead you beyond, or that is, that transcends, that can lead you to a transcendental experience. Provisions for the other shore. And here we are in this phenomenal world. It is a very comfortable world. It's comfortable because we know it. I don't care how miserable your world is, it's comfortable to you because this is what you know. Strange as that may seem. Now, when you leave this world for the other shore, that which transcends this, the noumenal world, instead of the phenomenal world, when you leave this shore, you're alone. And it is as if you're going to cross this great ocean. no information that you have gathered, nothing that you have read, nothing that you have seen, nothing that you have heard is going to be of any help. So what does one do about provisions? I mean, you got to get ready to go. Somehow, you know. Well, you know, if this is a journey that we're going to take alone, then maybe what we need are certain qualities. And these qualities then are called, or the Buddha called them at any rate, paramitas. And they follow you like a shadow. Now the word paramita comes from the word parama, which means the highest, or the acme, or we could say ichiban, the top of the line. Yeah? Or a paramita is to reach the other shore of, you know, to go from samsara to nirvana. Or it is enlightenment by crossing the sea of life and death, paramita. From the shore of delusion to the shore of truth. Paramita. So, we're going to talk about those this morning. I mean, if you're going to learn, you might as well learn ABC. Because the first paramita is giving. It's generosity. Some of you are very generous, and it is called in the Sanskrit, dana. Now, our minds, being associated with the ego, that is what they call the kama, rupa world, name form, which is desire, ego, it is identified with it, and it's like a miser with it. It tries to hold on. A little piece of information and you hang on to it. Or a feeling about somebody and you hang on to it. Or your anger and you hang on to it. It's a miser. This hanging on, this holding on, this clinging, and it tries to possess. This is a closed mind. If you're trying to possess something, trying to cling to something, your fist is closed. You're not open. You don't allow any windows and doors to be open so that a little fresh breeze can come through, you know, bring in a little more light. You know, afraid that what you're clinging to is going to leave or is going to escape you. And no matter how miserable you are in that state, it mustn't leave. You know, it's like our monk, and we dump a lot of things on his head, but he's understanding. But anyway, he went to court one day, and we find him standing in front of the magistrate saying, "This is too much, just too much. I can't tolerate anymore. It's too much. I live with my family in a very small room. I live there, my wife lives there, my 12 children live there. My wife is very possessive. She has a few goats in the house, and the children have a dog. And it is all becoming so dirty, it stinks, and I can't live there anymore. So I've come to ask for a separation." Well, the magistrate looked at him and he says, "But don't you have any windows? Can't you open the windows?" "What? And let my pigeons out?" You see? Well, it's not so funny, is it? When one begins in this, you know, sharing must be practiced until it's simply a part of one. When it's a part of one, you can forget about it because you will do it automatically. You know, share what you have. You know, in the final analysis, nothing belongs to us. You know? We can use and use anything that comes along, but don't try to possess it. Don't try to own it. The things that we try to possess were here before we were. Love was here before we were. We're just sort of joining in with it. Hmm? Yeah. It will be here when we leave. Who possesses it? It's here. Empty-handed we come, you know, and empty-handed we go, is the old saying. So while you are in this world, don't be like fists. You know, be open-handed. Huh? Open-minded. Huh? Open-handed is open-minded, you know. Hands are the extension of the mind. That's how science developed more and more. We have thumbs, and they oppose the fingers. And through the use of hands, a lot of thinking came about. Yeah. Now, Buddha doesn't mention what it is that we're supposed to share. Actually, it's not important. You know, you can share a song. You can share a smile. You can share a dance. You can share this feeling of joyousness. You know? You can share your house. You know? You can share a meal. Whatever. You know? But sharing is important. This generosity of spirit. We find ourselves, though, however, as much as we would like to be sharing, we are sitting on this shore, a lot of it because of possession. And I don't mean actual things, possessions, feelings that we own, we think we own. Huh? So then comes the practice of sitting for meditation. So we sit and we sit and we sit until we can let go. You know, it's a strange thing. We seem to trust these possessions. Very strange, huh? We trust almost anything and everything except that vast infinite, except the divine. Oh, in our hearts we may turn with prayer to the divine, but let go of yourself and trust it. That seems another story. What great blessings do your possessions have? Compared to that immeasurable light. Yeah. You know, Oscar and Sydney, they had a very profitable little business. They imported artificial flowers. And mainly it was profitable due to their seldom, if ever, paying Uncle Sam. Finally, to their loft came, as it must to all men, the agents of the IRS. Yeah. And there they found Oscar in charge, because Sydney was on a buying trip. And so the first agent explained the nature of the visit. "Mr. Oscar, you people are doing business and failing to report to the government." And Oscar turned purple. "Report? What report? Report? What report? What's to report?" "Well," the agent said, "first of all, we would like to know about your dependents, your exemptions." So Oscar proceeded to tell him about Harriet, his wife, dependent number one, and all the aggravations that she had been to him during his life. And then he got to his son, and the many problems from that scene, which we won't go into. And then dependent number three was his daughter. She's a good girl, but she's no beauty, and therefore she's costing a lot of money. I have to get her married off somehow, you know? So finally, this agent, despairing of Oscar's private life, said, "Mr. Oscar, let's forget all that for a moment and concentrate on the business itself." "Like what exactly?" Like, how much business are you doing? And what are the assets worth? And how much profit have you made? What? Are you crazy? I don't even tell my partner that. That's not sharing. As an example, huh? Yeah. No. You know how to share. You know what to do with yourself. Sharing is giving of yourself. So the second now paramita is observing the precepts or observing the commandments. And in a way, this means discipline. It doesn't mean to have a rigid character. It means a grace in living. It means that there is a certain elegance, you know, and there is a certain compassion. It is a life that is responsible. It is a life that cares for others. It is a discipline of oneself that rises out of understanding. You know, a precept is a way to conduct oneself. See? A certain way that a thing is done. And one does it out of understanding. So one is ready to learn. Story is important. Huh? Ready to learn. One is open to learn. This kind of an awareness. You know, if you're not aware of what you're doing and what's going on around you, you can't learn. No, at the end of the day, you can just simply write it off and say, today I goofed. In order to learn anything, your mind has to be together and with it. I'm full of stories today. Today, now we're going to talk about Sibley. And he was a Sufi mystic. And he was asked once by one of his students, who guided you on the path? See, I mean, it's like you would come and say to me, who guided you along the way? Well, you know who did. But this man answered, a dog. One day I saw this dog, and he was almost dead with thirst. And he's standing there at the edge of a pool. And every time he looked in the water, he saw a dog. You know, he saw his reflection. And he became frightened and withdrew. You know, when a dog is ill, it avoids all other dogs. I mean, when a cat is ill, it avoids all other cats. Animal is ill, it avoids all animals. They'll tear it to pieces. So here is this dog. So thirsty, he can barely stand, and he leans over the water to take a drink, and there's a dog. So he backs up. However, finally his thirst became so great that he threw away the fear, and he leaped into the water. Now, all of him is in the water now, at which point, of course, the other dog vanished. This Sibley says, you know, the dog found that the obstacle was himself. And in the same way, my own obstacle vanished when I knew that what I took to be myself was simply a reflection and not reality. You learn from a dog. We can learn from anything, anywhere, if the mind is open and it is a learning position. You know, there are 250 commandments or some precepts in the Buddhist tradition for the monks. For the women, there's another 100. He had a little difficulty keeping them under control, I guess. But one learns them, you know, as a discipline. You know. Then when one knows them as a discipline, then you find out There's something more intended than those little words that go running through our head. You know, simply, there is a commandment that is in every religion. Thou shalt not kill. So in India, you don't kill a fly, and you don't kill a beetle, and you don't kill a cow, or anything like that. But what about you do not kill the Christ within you? How about that, you know? We learn first as children, and then we learn as grown-ups, you know. And if we discipline ourselves, you know, the capacity to learn rises. And this capacity to learn is not something that you can borrow. You know, you can't go to the store and say, I'll have so many of these, and I'll, here's a dollar. No. It's the same thing, you know, you don't go to a mirror and ask the mirror how many people it has reflected. No. Discipline so that you are mirror-like. Learning yourself. The third is a practice of patience. Or forbearance. This journey that we are on is such a one that you cannot be in a hurry. You need a lot of patience. So we forget all about the when this great event is going to happen. Have some patience with yourself and have some patience with others. Just relax and have some patience. Stop rushing around so fast that you can't even see. The day when you can relax, you know, in your patience, and you can sit silently, you will become aware of a presence. And it is so present that the room is filled with it. Then you see that the whole world is filled with it. Everything, everywhere is full of God. Patience. Don't crowd yourself. Have the patience. And then, of course, we need some courage. And we need some energy. And they call this painstaking labor. Yeah. We should not waste life's energy unnecessarily. I mean, we have a wing-ding here and a wing-ding there, and you've thrown it away. One should not have leakages, either in the mind or as far as one's energy is concerned. You know, we run around and we're always leaking out. Buddha sat under a Bodhi tree doing what? He simply sat there so silently, so together, that there were no leakages of his energy. So that the energy was building and building in himself. You know, the energy that the Buddha had, you have the same energy. Same energy. There's not a whole bunch of energies running around here saying, I'll choose this one or that one. Same energy. On what are you using it? You gather the energy together, and it compacts. And there is a quality about you that changes because of this compacted energy. Painstaking labor. Then we come to meditation, which is also called silence. It is also tranquility and the virtue of calmness. So one allows it to penetrate one's life more and more. I mean, it isn't that you always are in the sitting position. There are all different kinds of postures, Buddhist postures, Don't create unnecessary occupations. One is silent, one becomes more collected, one becomes more centered, one becomes more fulfilled. Are you all getting chilly? Oh, just the two of you. When one is centered, I don't know whether you know this or not, but when one is centered, your face changes. I see, you know, the jiggajitsu walking up and down, you can tell right away if you're really holding a focus or not. Your face changes. And then your eyes change. All your worries may be the same. They're going to continue. The world isn't going to change after all, you know, just because you shut up for a while. But through your own meditation, you will be different. Everything's going to be the same. Nothing will be the same because of the way you look at it. But people think there's going to be a lot of changes in the world, that you're not going to have any problems anymore, or this, that, or the other, and that's not true. You know, there is a saying in this Western world of ours that an empty mind is the devil's workshop. And I think that saying was invented by the devil. Yeah? The silent mind is God's workshop. As soon as there's a thought, in comes the devil. Without a thought, there's no possibility of him. None. The only possibility in this silent mind is that the truth rises, and it's already there. Nothing to enter. And then we come to this prajna, wisdom. And if one attains wisdom, one answers a great many questions about the universe and about your individual life. You know, this wisdom sitting, it blossoms, whether you're aware of it or not. If you're really sitting, you know, it blossoms in your soul. Your wisdom, yours, blossoming in you. It's like the old, you know, there's a koan about it, like the little monk who's leaving the roshi, his quarters. He'd been in there talking to the roshi for a while, and it was a very dark night, and it was very late, and the monk was a little bit apprehensive because he had to pass through a dark forest on his way to his own quarters. So the roshi saw this fear, and he asked him, he says, "Are you afraid of the darkness?" "Yes, I'm afraid." So the roshi said, "Don't be afraid." And he lit a candle and he gave it to him. And as the monk was walking out the door, the roshi blew it out. And the little monk says, "I don't understand. You light a candle for me with such compassion. Why did you blow it out?" And this roshi said, "My candle is not much use to you. Be a light unto yourself. Go into the dark night with many blessings, but relying on your own consciousness. Remain alert. Let that be your light, your alertness." And there is another story. It's a Hasidic story. And it was a disciple of a rabbi, and without telling his teacher anything, he was beginning to inquire into the nature of God, until in his thinking he was all tangled up. What had been for sure, for certain at one time, now he was very uncertain of. And the rabbi noticed that the young man wasn't coming anymore, so he went into the city to see him, and he asked him, you know, "What's the matter?" And he looked at him and he says, "Oh, I know what's the matter with you. You have passed through the 50 gates of reason. You begin with a question, and you think and you think and you think and you think and you think. And all of a sudden, you think an answer, and the first gate opens. It opens to a new question. And again, you mill around and mill around and mill around until you find an answer. And you fling open the second gate. And there's the third gate, another question. One by one by one, you do this until you come to the 50th gate. You know? Then you are staring at a question whose answer no man can give you. And if you dare to probe any further, you plunge into an abyss. And this disciple looked at his teacher and he says, "You mean to tell me I have to go all the way back to the beginning?" "Don't go back," said the rabbi. "Take one step and you will be standing beyond the last gate. You will find yourself standing in faith." And that was Buddha's wisdom. Now, in the primitive Buddhism, there were the six paramitas. And later, seeing that this pranya, this wisdom, opened out, so there are four more. And here we have now skillful means, contrivances. Use a boat to cross and throw the boat away. I'm going to hurry through these things now. And then there is the will to do. Sometimes we call it supplication. You do everything you possibly can do, and then you turn it over. And in the turning over, you know, or the letting go is what we usually call it, there's this little prayer in your heart. No words. It's just a supplication. You do everything that you possibly can do, and then just relax. And then it comes a moment, and then you do everything again you possibly can do, and then relax. Then we have to have strength. There is a power, and after we have done everything we can do, then this power is present. And then there is this jnana, you know, where from whence cometh the words jnana yoga, which is the intellect, as opposed to raja yoga, which is the heart and the head, the path of the heart and the mind. Raja yoga is what we do here. So this tenth, this jnana, means truthfully comprehending the ultimate nature. Truthfully comprehending the ultimate nature. That is, seeing directly into the nature of things. When you have done everything that you can do, and you have let go, the totality is all that there is. The totality. And they call this the encounter of nirvana, the realization of totality without a self. O monks, you must not walk on the way as the ox that is attached to the wheel. His body moves, but his heart is not willing. Well, I think we all know about this. If you're ready to move to the other shore, without looking back, having no regrets at the possessions you're going to leave, that when you come back to them, you're no longer going to own them. All you're going to have is use of them. If you can do that, then you're ready. Then your heart is in accord with the way. And you don't go reluctantly then. You don't go with a lot of resistance then. Some of us have a great deal of resistance against this thing. You know, it's almost as if you're going against yourself. So you simply move with the stream like you're a log in the river. Just move with it. That energy is in you. Just move with it. And those who practice the way might well follow the example of an ox. Here's for this week. that marches through the deep mire carrying a heavy load. He is tired, but his steady gaze, looking forward, will never relax until he comes out of the mire, and it is only then that he takes respite. Zennists say that the effortless effort is needed. You know, it's a harmony of effort and no effort. You know, to do, and then to let go. If you rely only on your own effort, you may never reach. If you rely only on God's grace, you may never reach. It's got to be both. The possibility to reach the other shore comes about when you have done all that you can do. And don't fool yourself in here with doing that I have done all that I can do. Do each thing that you can do, and then do some more. Practice these paramitas. Don't be lazy. Bring all of your energy to the sitting. Become totally involved in the sitting. That is, totally involved in yourself without a thought. And surrender when you have done all that you can do. And there's two types of sitters. You know, one says, well, it's going to happen by grace. Well, of course it does. But, you know, this one says, well, it'll happen when God wants it to happen. All I have to do is just sit here and wait. Well, that kind of waiting is impotent, huh? They haven't even taken the first step. No, they're just sitting, waiting. Goes nowhere. Then there are those who say, well, it's going to happen by my effort. I have to do it. I am the one that's important, and I am doing this thing, and I will do it all the way through. You know, and feeling almost as if the whole universe is very indifferent to them. And this isn't true. Reality is just in the middle of these two stances. First, make all the effort that you can. Go to the very end. Genuine, sincere effort. Don't fool yourself. It's hard work. Hard work effort. And then let go. It's like it's a struggle plus a surrender. And it brings you home. Or you're already there. You don't know it. And now, may the peace and the power that passeth all understanding hold us and keep us in the love of the Christed consciousness while we are seemingly separate one from another. And I do thank you very much, and I will see you at 7:30.
If you find Lola's talks valuable, more will be posted in weeks to come.